Carl Jung, the father of analytical psychology, once said, quote, "There is a God about whom you know nothing, because men have forgotten him. We call him by his name, Abraxas. He is less definite than God or devil." Abraxas is a word found in Gnostic text, and was also found engraved on certain antique gemstones called Abraxas stones, which were used as amulets or charms. It is similar to the word abracadabra, an incantation used in magic that means "I create as I speak" in Hebrew and Phoenician, or "I create like the word" in Aramaic. That said, Abraxas was common in Greek, where it was originally spelled a bit differently as Abrasax, then changed to its current spelling by Latin authors, but still usually appeared with a lion or rooster-headed man with serpentine legs holding the shield of wisdom and the whip of power, or sometimes a sword, scepter, or trident. Abraxas is also invoked in Aleister Crowley's 1913 work, The Gnostic Mass. To understand its meaning, one must look at the Kabbalistic formula derived from the letters, and such as the number 365 derived from abracadabra, the number of days in a year, and the number of heavens and spirits emanating from the god Abraxas in Basilidan Gnosticism. Basilides was an early Christian Gnostic religious leader in Alexandria, Egypt, who taught from 117 to 138 AD. He's believed to have written over 24 books of commentary on the Christian gospel, none of which have survived until today, but are partially preserved in the writings of others. That said, his followers formed a movement that persisted for at least 2 centuries after him, known as Basilidan Gnosticism, which in part allegedly survives in some secret societies and mystery schools. Like other Gnostics, Basilides taught that salvation comes through knowledge and not faith. This knowledge, or gnosis, was considered esoteric and received through revelation by alchemical means. Faith played no part in salvation. Basilides taught a heretical version of Christ's passion. In Christianity, the passion refers to the short final period in the life of Jesus, and according to the Gnostic perspective, Jesus did not actually die on the cross. According to the Gospel of Basilides, which was in circulation during the 3rd century, the person who died on the cross was named Simon of Cyrene. 2 other Gnostic texts share this view of the crucifixion in the Nag Hammadi Library. One is called the Apocalypse of Peter, and the second is the Treaty of the Great Seth. The Nag Hammadi Library is a collection of 13 early Christian texts discovered near the Egyptian town of Nag Hammadi in 1945. The name Seth refers to the 3rd son of Adam and Eve and brother of Cain and Abel. According to the book of Genesis, Seth was born when Adam was 130 years old. It is said that late in life, Adam gave Seth secret teachings that would become the Kabbalah. In the Zohar, Seth is referred to as ancestor of all generations of the righteous ones. Josephus refers to Seth as a virtuous and excellent character, reports that his descendants invented the wisdom of the heavenly bodies, meaning astronomy and astrology, and the Sethians were a Christian Gnostic sect who predate Christianity, and although Seth is not mentioned in the Quran, to my knowledge, he is still revered in most Islamic tradition, and usually in a positive light, especially in some Sufi sects. That said, the Treaty of the Great Seth is written from the first-person perspective of Jesus. Quote, "For my death, which they think happened to them in their error and blindness, since they nailed their man onto their death. It was another, their father, who drank the gall and the vinegar. It was not I. They struck me with the reed. It was another, Simon, who bore the cross on his shoulder. It was another upon whom they placed the crown of thorns, and I was laughing at their ignorance." So from the Gnostic perspective, Jesus was a spirit that could not die, but could enter into and influence living bodies. I understand what follows is controversial and new to many, as this material has only recently been translated and made public. So keep in mind that I share it in an educational context, not as an endorsement of what you should or shouldn't believe. Moving on, at the beginning of the text, Jesus states, quote, "I visited a bodily dwelling. I cast out the one who was in it previously, and I went in." This sounds a lot like the New Age concept of a walk-in, where a soul has somehow departed a body and is replaced with a new, different soul. The Gnostic view also maintains that the God of the Hebrew Bible was not the one true God, but rather an inferior being called a demiurge, a term that originates in Platonic philosophy that describes the figure responsible for maintaining the physical universe, and later adopted by the early Christian Gnostics. The Gnostics portrayed the demiurge as a lion-headed dragon, in part due to astrotheology, more specifically an aspect of Egyptian astronomy important to the Sethians, as well as symbolic of the Gnostic or alchemical mysteries. The demiurge was placed in the 13th heaven, and as one researches the subject, they will encounter various names of lion-headed gods with wings, wrapped in a serpent, and associated with demons, which, as I've stated previously, to the ancient Phoenicians, classical Greeks, and Hellenistic Egyptians, and ancient Mesopotamians in general, demons were not necessarily considered evil. Plato adapted the term demiurge, which in ancient Greece had originally been the ordinary word for craftsman, and used it to describe the agent that takes the pre-existing materials of chaos, arranges them according to the models of eternal forms, and produces all the physical things in the world, including human bodies. In the later Gnostic worldview, which is dualistic in nature, the demiurge came to represent one of the forces of evil, responsible for the creation of the despised material world and associated with the Abrahamic God, and in opposition of the God of goodness. So it is from this context that one of the reasons the Catholic Church viewed Gnostic sects as heretical and imposed the death penalty, burning members alive, and in some cases totally exterminating and genociding entire religious demographics, such as the Cathars. Another reason is that the Gnostic sects engaged in sacred sexual unions that the religious establishment banned, and it was through some of these forbidden sexual acts that divine knowledge or gnosis was accessed. And this carnal activity predates Plato, predates dynastic Egypt, predates Babylon, Sumerians, and the Holocene altogether, and allegedly goes back to the time of Atlantis. In ancient Egyptian religion, Seth, or Set, was a storm god, commonly associated with the planet Mercury, the color red, and during the period attributed to the Hyksos, which translates to rulers of foreign lands, they chose Set as their patron deity and worshipped him as their chief god. The Hyksos king, Apophis, is recorded as worshipping Set exclusively, as described in the following passage. "He chose for his lord the god Set. He did not worship any other deity in the whole land except Set." Set is sometimes depicted as a red-haired beast with a forked tail and cloven hooves, and primarily associated with the serpent. Set was incorporated into the early mythology of Christianity as the devil. Set's relationship to darkness and wickedness, as well as the color red, and the popular image of him as a red-haired beast, all lent themselves to the iconography of the Christian Satan. The Sethians were one of the main currents of Gnosticism during the 2nd and 3rd century, and while they predate the time of Jesus, they came to symbolically identify Seth with Christ. Now I'd like to play a short interview with Dr. Dylan Burns discussing the Sethian Gnostics in a bit more depth.
Who were the Sethians? Who were the Sethian Gnostics?
This is unfortunately a much more complicated question than it has to be. But the short answer would be that we have two ancient testimonies about groups that called themselves Sethians, one from a 3rd century church father named Hippolytus, who was in Rome, and a scholar writing around the turn of the 5th century named Epiphanius of Salamis. Neither of the individuals that they describe as Sethians seem to have much to do, as far as we can tell, theologically or sociologically, with the group of texts that scholars today call Sethian Gnostic literature. This latter group of texts is a group of documents discovered at Nag Hammadi, which is in Upper Egypt, in 1945. Texts probably written in Greek and preserved in Coptic, the later language of Roman and medieval Egypt. And in the 1970s, a German scholar named Hans Martin Schenke recognized that a subgroup of these texts from Nag Hammadi seem to share a kind of mythological system.
Okay.
Various kinds of deities and angels, baptismal language, baptismal traditions, and especially veneration of the figure of Seth, the third child of Adam and Eve, the good one.
Right.
As revealer and savior. And because of this focus on Seth, he called this literature Sethian Gnostic literature. Now, no Sethian text says this was written by the Sethians.
Right.
And so, as you may note as you read my book, I try not to talk about the Sethians or the Sethian Gnostics, actually, because we don't have any evidence for Sethians who read Sethian literature. Rather, we have this particular body of texts that scholars might say preserve Sethian traditions in the same way that we talk about apocalyptic traditions, even though we don't talk about the apocalypticists as a social group.
Right.
This is an important distinction because scholarship in the 70s to the 90s or so did talk about Sethians, assuming that there must have been a concrete social group that called themselves Sethians that produced this literature about the figure of Seth. But that's actually an assumption that I'm not so sure we should make. However, we do know that there were particular groups of people bringing this sort of literature together and discussing it, and we can locate these people at a particular place and time. Whether or not we want to call them Sethians is a technical question. It wouldn't be unreasonable to do so, but I don't do it in my book. One group, of course, are the people who put together the Nag Hammadi text in the first place. They obviously knew all the Sethian literature and bound it together, along with a lot of other texts, Valentinian texts, liturgical texts, mm-hmm. and so forth. The Gospel of Thomas, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, and this is where the story gets very interesting, a 3rd century philosopher named Porphyry, writing probably at the end of the 3rd century, but about a period of his time, of his life, where he was in Rome in the 260s CE, studying with another great philosopher named Plotinus,
mm-hmm.
very famous for influencing yeah. St. Augustine, says that in around 263 or so, there were some Christians who were involved with our group. They were heretics. They said that they had other authorities, so they trusted on metaphysical matters more than Plato. This is a Platonic mm-hmm. group. And they read books with the names like this, Zostrianos, Autogenes, Nicotheos, and so forth. The names of some of these texts are the same as names of some of the texts we have from Nag Hammadi. And then when we compare what Porphyry, who says that his master Plotinus wrote a book against these people, and what Plotinus says about the books that these people had, when we compare that with some of the Nag Hammadi material, which has the same titles, as the books that Porphyry mentions, we see that it's obviously some kind of version of the same literature. So we know that this literature that scholars today like to call Sethian Gnostic was circulating in a philosopher's circle in around 263 CE. And this allows us to be able to say, okay, some of this very intense Gnostic apocalyptic tradition was actually being discussed by Greek philosophers and by people who knew about Greek philosophy in Rome in around 263. And that tells us that, that gives us a window into diagnosing the socio-cultural background of a particular group of Gnostics. This is important because we have next to no other information about Gnostics from a socio-historical angle. The church fathers don't tell us a lot about what Gnostics were like, except that they were Christians and then their congregations. But philosophers' reading groups were a much more particular, concrete setting. Not a lot of people were rich enough and well-connected enough to even make it to such a group. So this tells us that these Gnostics were very well-educated, they're politically connected. Plotinus's circle often met in the palaces of the emperor in Rome itself. Absolutely. They're, in order to be reading this difficult Greek philosophical literature, they must have achieved something like a postgraduate education today, working on Greek philosophy. So, but at the same time, they were very suspicious of the authoritative traditions of Greek education, which is to say, Greek historians, Greek philosophers like Plato and Aristotle and so forth. They wanted to invoke the authorities of sages like Zostrianos and Autogenes with very Jewish-sounding names and revelatory texts that had very Jewish themes and motifs that would have been persuasive in a Jewish or Christian environment. That's really an interesting thing.
That is an interesting thing, because one of the things I know had been discussed before the show was that at one point it was people were trying to place Gnosticism in pagan communities, but
that's right.
Changing. That's changing.
Absolutely, that's a great question. The particular text that we know to have circulated in Plotinus' circle do not mention Jesus Christ as the Savior. They don't talk about Jesus of Nazareth. And so when they were initially discovered and translated, the scholars working on them said, well, they must be pagan, because we know that they were in a pagan philosophical group and they don't talk about Jesus or quote the New Testament. It's got to be that simple, right?
Right.
Well, not really, actually, because the sort of myths that these stories contain and the way that they communicate the knowledge that they want to pass on to the reader are done in the idiom and tone of what scholars today call late antique apocalyptic literature or Hellenistic apocalyptic literature. These are texts like First Enoch or Second Enoch, pseudepigraphic literature, which uses the technique of pseudepigraphy, which is writing a text and then assigning the name of somebody who's very authoritative within a particular social group, like Enoch or Abraham or Moses, what have you. In order to assert a lot of authority over what is being communicated. There are other aspects of these texts that are nothing like what you find in contemporary Greek intellectual life, but Jewish and Christian apocalyptic literature. For example, the texts themselves are apocalypses, which means revelations, texts that are communicated through from heaven to a particular seer or prophet by some kind of intermediary, usually an angel. These angels are grumpy, and the seers or prophets are upset. There's a lot of emotional storm und drang that drives these people to obtain their revelations. And there are particular idioms and niceties you find in this text. For example, these seers, they like to ride on clouds. The journey to heaven is described as a scary place. They're intimidated. They need to be reassured once in a while. All of this is very common in the Jewish pseudepigraphic literature of the period, and very strange in the Greek philosophical context. So what we see then is that these Gnostic apocalypses that were in Plotinus' circle, and I argue in my book, the majority of the Sethian literature itself seems to come from a place that's not exactly Christian or Jewish, but from groups that are between them, from the borderlines between our modern sense of Judaism and Christianity. And this actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. There were lots of biblically informed or Abrahamic groups, as it were, in Syria, the Middle East, in Rome, that did not necessarily belong to the ancient Catholic Church or identify Jesus of Nazareth as the chief savior and prophet, but on the other hand, were not easily assimilatable to Greco-Roman religion either. So the authors of the Sethian texts, whether or not we choose to call them Sethians, were people from one of these groups. And they pro they we know that they had a very strong interest in baptism. There's a lot of
Okay.
baptismal language in this literature. And yet there also is some anti-baptismal polemic. Some of these texts argue that the true baptism is not of water, but it's of light, it's of spirit.
Okay.
And we know that there were a lot of baptismal groups in Mesopotamia and especially Syria in the second and third centuries from attestations from other church fathers of the period. And one anti-baptismal thinker who grew up in such a baptismal group was Mani, the founder of the religion known as Manichaeism, arguably the first world religion. And due to these and due to the similarity to Mani and his thought with respect to baptismal thought, conjoined to anti-baptismal polemic, and then other aspects of Sethian texts that are actually quite particular and uncommon, such as, for example, affirmation of the belief in reincarnation of souls. Not a lot of Judeo-Christian groups affirmed that at the time. Due to such this these and other shared characteristics with Manichaeism, I think that the Sethian literature probably comes from some kind of baptismal milieu in Syria or Mesopotamia in the third century. We have a link to Rome because Hippolytus, who I mentioned earlier, knew of some kind of Sethian group in Rome at the time, says that a missionary from one of these Mesopotamian Baptist groups, the Elchasites, came to Rome, a man named Alcibiades, and he brought books with him. And I wonder if perhaps it's this Alcibiades who transmitted these Sethian traditions to Rome, which is how they would have come into the hands of the Christian heretics known to Porphyry, who he called Gnostics.
Okay, thank you for that. It's fascinating. Now, one thing that I have to say, you're talking about these Gnostics as being seriously educated people, postgraduate education, all that. Now, while not so long ago, a scholar, Larry Hurtado, said that the Gnostics were not intellectuals. And he kind of, and that kind of caused a bit of a kerfuffle. What would you, I mean, he basically said they were kind of elitist, they weren't trying to defend their opinions in public, that sort of thing. What you're describing sounds a little different than that.
I think the Professor Hurtado was not thinking about the people in Porphyry's circle. And I
Okay.
remember visiting his blog and looking at the comment section. Somebody brought up the Gnostics in Plotinus' circle, and he had to say, well, obviously these are very educated people. My guess is that what he was going for was saying that Gnostic literature as we possess it is largely revelatory. It relies on the authority of revelation. It's,
Yeah, it does.
These texts don't really make philosophical arguments. They tell you how it is, and they do it by telling a story that may or really hit you hard or leave you cold. That's what apocalypses do. It's a particular genre. It's a literary form, and in this sense, it is not very philosophical, because this is not how investigation works in the Greek philosophical tradition, which relies on logos, rationality, demonstration, which to a very large extent defines for us philosophy today. So there's also an interesting extent to which we can talk very generally about the relationship between revelatory thought or apocalypticism versus philosophy in general and looking at the Plotinus-Gnostic conflict, Greek philosophy versus revelatory literature. And I think that's what Hurtado was going for. But to say that Gnostics were not educated people was, of course, a misjudgment, and that is refuted by the historical evidence.
Okay.
When we talk about the revelation and the importance of it in these groups' texts, Were they trying to duplicate what was in the text and experience it for themselves? Are these experiences that people actually had? Were they trying to ascend and have these apocalyptic experiences for themselves, would you say?
It's a difficult question because all we have are the textual artifacts. We don't have any, how to put it, magical diaries by Gnostics that say, well, you know, I was trying out the apocalypse of Zostrianus after fasting for 3 days and spinning around in circles, and then I saw some angels. Instead, we have the texts that come that purport to be experiences of an ancient seer having these ascents. Of course, there's an endless scholarly debate going on about whether these texts testify to experiences or what scholars call literary cliché, whether the claim to have an experience is simply a way of asserting authority for what one is trying to communicate. There are arguments to be made for both perspectives. However, one of these texts, a very interesting liturgical text from Nag Hammadi and Nag Hammadi Codex 7, it's called the Three Steles of Seth. It says, we see, we see, we see, we bless you, we glorify you, we have been saved. This first person plural language leads me to think that it's meant to be recited in a group, and that means we have a concrete social setting, probably for people who believed that in performing these liturgies, they attained some kind of similarity to angelic beings and were uplifted and attained, at least for a temporary period, a kind of semi-divine state, as it were.
I'd like to briefly address a point he made about the Gnostic baptism of light. I offer this explanation in an effort to make this knowledge public, not to convince anyone of anything. And I'm aware that most will disagree or not understand it, so I'll keep it brief. My goal is simply to make this public, as there was a time that one would be killed for divulging this, and most who are already familiar are sworn by oath to remain silent. That said, in an occult and esoteric context, the symbolic act of being baptized by water, being immersed in a river, lake, or tub, or the religious act of sprinkling water onto a person's forehead, symbolizing purification, regeneration, or initiation into a church, actually alludes to the alchemical context of water, which is sex energy, ens seminis, a term used by Paracelsus, a Swiss physician, alchemist, and philosopher of the German Renaissance. The three principal alchemical elements are mercury, sulfur, and salt, which constitute water, fire, and earth. These three work together in what alchemists call the great work. So mercury, represented by Hermes, or in this case Set, is regarded as the messenger of Christ and as sex energy, must be transferred into sulfur, or spirit, through the medium of earth, or salt, which is the physical body. So water is the source of all creation, and the alchemical transformation is alluded to in the word abraxas, which has seven letters, each of which represents one of the seven classic planetary gods, meaning the five visible planets plus the sun and the moon, and these seven symbolically also represent the seven chakras or spiritual energy centers within the human body spoken about in Eastern religions and tantric philosophy. In a prior video, I spoke about the origin of language, which I will leave a link to in the description, but I did not address the vowels, as the oldest scripts, such as Hebrew or Phoenician, are only comprised of consonants. I will now reveal the esoteric secret of the vowels. In writing systems, based on the Latin alphabet, the letters A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y and W can all be used to represent vowels. These are sometimes alluded to as the unspeakable name of God, and it is reciting, humming or chanting these sounds, that a vibration is created in the body, more specifically the lungs, which touch the spinal cord, that helps to raise the energy from the lower chakras up to the higher ones. In other words, whether they themselves are aware of it or not, when you hear a monk in meditation chanting Om, that is what they're doing. Incidentally, it's no accident that the letter M, which is part of the Om sound, is the 13th letter. You might also notice that one method of the seated lotus position has the heel of the foot pressed up against what is called the perineum, which when combined with Kegels can also activate the energy that is then circulated through the use of the sacred vowels. This is a big subject, and my intention is not to teach it here to any workable degree, but simply to disclose it, as I believe this knowledge belongs to all people of all religions, not just secret societies, especially the men who are only taught porn and degeneracy in this modern global culture. Now I'd like to play another short interview excerpt on the Sethians, the seed of Seth, who regarded themselves as a specific race descended from Seth, the third offspring of Adam and Eve, a genetic line which they traced down to Noah, whose three sons and the civilizations they founded spread out from the Caucasus Mountains, from where we get the term Caucasian from.
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Sethians.
One of the most interesting things about the Sethians is that we have talked and we'll talk a lot about Gnosticism in the broadest sense. But the Gnostics, the classical Gnostics, when scholars refer to them, they're usually referring to Sethians in particular. And they were they took their name from Seth, who was the third son of Adam and Eve. And they referred to themselves as the seed of Seth, the generation of Seth, the immovable race. They saw the descendants of Seth as those who would be capable of receiving Gnosis, unlike the offspring of Cain and Abel. John Turner, who is one of the leading scholars on Sethianism, has suggested that their origin was probably something like the Mandaeans, who still survive, that they probably began as a baptismal sect, possibly associated with disciples of John the Baptist or the Essenes or similar movements who practiced baptism as ritual purification.
Yeah, and so you see a lot of crossover then between the Sethians and the kind of apocalyptic Judaic groups of the same period. In the fact that even the character of Seth, or if you want to call him a character, he appears in a lot of the apocalyptic Jewish literature of the same time period.
Yeah, he was a prominent figure in heterodox and mystical Jewish literature, and always it had been for some time. As the third son of Adam and Eve, he was sort of seen as the one that was you know, Adam with Cain and Abel, you had a murderer and a victim, and with Seth, you sort of had a new beginning. And then the Gnostics, Sethian Gnostics, just took that idea and really ran with it.
The Sethians were also referred to, probably by people outside of their group, as Barbelloites, right, or Barbello Gnostics. And why is that?
Well, that's because one of the most important figures in the Gnostic cosmology, and I guess we'll get into this in a minute when we talk about the Apocrypha of John in a little bit of detail. But one of the most significant figures was Barbello, who was the first emanation from the ineffable God, and she's sort of the mother of all. Although she's also referred to as the mother and the father and the thrice male, So it's one of those. She's one of those interesting figures in Gnostic cosmologies, which in which gender is used and applied in different ways, as well as the reference to an androgynous nature.
Mm-hmm. I often think about, because she's also known as the thrice powerful or the triple power, and I often think about Hermes Trismegistus along the same lines, and I don't know for sure, but I wonder if the two are related, if there's a kind of hermetic Sethian crossover. I mean, certainly those two kind of ideas were being developed in the same time, in the same place, so be interesting. It would have been great to be a fly on the wall back then.
Oh, sure. And, unlike the Valentinians, who we'll talk about later, who were always and definitely a Christian group, the Sethians didn't start out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Before they sort of interacted with the nascent Christian community, they already had a functioning mythology in which Seth was the savior figure, and that it was Seth who was going to come again at the end of the age. And it was only later that they sort of really cut and pasted the Jesus story into their scriptures.
So the Sethians have a trinity as well, but it's different from the traditional Christian trinity. There's a father, the mother, and the son. In the Sethian tradition, the father is referred to, among other names, as the invisible spirit, the virginal spirit. The mother is Barbello, and that's kind of typical of the early Gnostics, is they had a similar kind of framework with different stuff plugged into it.
Right, and you could make a comparison between the Origenes or the Anthropos and the Kabbalistic idea of Adam Kadmon.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of the archetypal pleromic human, the complete human.
Right, right. And then so further down the emanations, you have a demiurge, and Yaldabaoth, also known as Sacklus, and Samael, usually identified in this system with the god of the Hebrew Bible, but definitely evil, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the distinctions between the Sethians and the Valentinians, who we'll talk about later, is that in Sethian cosmology, the demiurge is evil. He's deliberately malicious, and he is an enemy of mankind. Whereas in the Valentinian viewpoint, he is less than God, and he's imperfect, but he's not necessarily evil. He's just less than divine. So they called him, Sacklus, Samael, the blind one, the fool.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things that sort of marks the Sethian movement, in that they saw the God of the Hebrew Bible as the demiurge, and because of this, there was a tendency to invert a lot of the stories of the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
Or the Hebrew Bible. Some groups of Sethians, for instance, saw the snake in the Garden of Eden. I think we'll talk about the Garden of Eden in a minute, but they saw the snake as the hero of the story, the incarnation of wisdom who delivered Adam and Eve from a false paradise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that specifically in the hypostasis of the Archons, is where that's kind of the big one, the
right.
Nature of the rulers.
The reality of the rulers.
Yeah. Well, now that we're talking about texts, let's jump down a bit. There are a number of texts that we have from a couple of different sources, the Nag Hammadi Library, of course, but also the Bruce Codex and the new newly translated Chakos Codex. Let me just run down a quick list of the Sethian texts that we have today so that the viewers at home can pick them out of their local library or read them on gnosis.org. So the Apocryphon of John, which is kind of the big one. We'll talk a little bit more in detail about that in just a minute. The Apocalypse of Adam, the Trimorphic Protonoia, which is just a lovely Greek phrase that means the three forms of the first thought. Hypostasis of the Archons, or the reality of the rulers or the nature of the rulers. Thought of Noria, Gospel of the Egyptians, or the Holy Book of the Great Invisible Spirit. Melchizedek, Three Steles of Seth. Sostrianos, Alogenes, the Stranger, Marcenes, and then in the Bruce Codex, there is an untitled text, along with the Apocryphon of John is also in the Bruce Codex. And then in Chakos, there's the Gospel of Judas and the Book of Alogenes, which is some newly translated stuff, but definitely Sethians. Anything you want to add, Bishop, before we move on to the Apocryphon of John specifically?
No.
Okay. All right, so let me go ahead and pull up my my charts here. I do like charts. Okay, so what are we looking at here? What's happening in the Apocryphon of John?
Well, let's start off with the Apocryphon of John. It was apparently a very popular text because it's one that we have multiple copies of in multiple forms, as a matter of fact. It contains the classic Gnostic myth, or a classic Gnostic myth, that's been Christianized by editorial insertions and insertion of a frame story. The version that we have that's been Christianized, some scholars seem to think that it shows influence from the canonical Gospel of John. And could even be seen as an esoteric, a more spiritual continuation of the canonical Gospel of John. So let's go into the cosmology a little bit. The basic myth begins with the invisible father, the primal father, the invisible monad, who is above and before everything, and the Apocryphon of John is very, very clearly describes him in apophatic terms. And we talked about apophatic theology last week. In short, it's description of the divine using negation, with the understanding that human concepts and language are insufficient. So the best way to describe the ineffable is to say what he's not. And in the Apocryphon of John, you find terms where he's, like he's described as illimitable, unsearchable, invisible, ineffable, immeasurable. And it goes into some detail explaining that he can't be measured or understood by human concepts. So this is the God that's before we can hang any ideas or concepts on him at all. The first emanation from the Invisible Father was Barbalo. Now, she is referred to as the mother. She's also referred to as the mother father and thrice male. And it's she's the initiator with the emanation of the additional aeons and the angelic forces who you've outlined on the chart there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she kind of begets foreknowledge, incorruptibility, eternal life, and truth. And these would have been Greek words that are kind of personifications of concepts. And so along with Barbello, these five are referred to as the pentad of the aeons of the Father, but they're also all five of them are androgynous. So there's actually 10 of them. They're also referred to as the decad of the aeons of the Father. And I just noticed a typo on my chart here. So we'll, the pentad of the aeons of the Father start off the whole shebang. And then Autogenes,
of course, means self-begotten, which is again, one of those interesting contradictions, in the same way that Barbalo is the mother and also the mother father and also thrice male, Artogenes, who is emanated by Barbalo and the primal father, is also called Artogenes, which means self-begotten. And Artogenes, in turn, becomes the source of other emanations.
Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets a bit dicey in the text. Definitely written with an older style of prose, and the translations reflect that. But there are fellow workers. Then Artogenes emanates the three, and then the four powers, and then emanates the four luminaries, Armazel, Oriel, Devithai, and Elalith. And these are kind of, I guess you'd say, the rulers over 12 aeons that form in four groups of three under each of them. So Armazel rules over grace, truth, and form. Oriel, pronoia, forethought, perception, and memory. Devithai, understanding, love, and likeness. And Elalith, perfection, peace, and Sophia, or wisdom.
So before we move on too much further into this, mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what aeons are?
Oh, good point, yes. Yeah, okay, so aeons, in a Gnostic sense, aeons are kind of spaces, and they're entities. And in a lot of cases, they also personify concepts. And in fact, in almost all of these cases, they have names that are just kind of words. They're not proper names, but, you know, like love and grace and understanding and will and thought. These are all aeons in the sense that they exist in the Pleroma before the cosmos came to exist. I'm not explaining this very well. Thomas, bail me out here.
Well, it is hard to put your finger on. They are one way to look at them is seeing them as aspects of the Godhead.
Mm-hmm.
We talked before about how the Monad, the Ineffable Father, is sort of beyond and before human concepts. As that divinity begins to manifest, to express himself, herself, it does so by emanating aspects of its character. And because they are divine, these aspects of character have a real existence as distinct personages in the Pleroma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, all right, so I just brought up the second slide here. At the bottom of the other slide, you'll notice that there was a dotted line, and this dotted line is reproduced here on the second slide. Sophia, the last of the 12 aeons to be emanated underneath the luminaries. So the third aeon of Elalith, Sophia or wisdom. She did a bad thing. She wanted to create something, but she did not get permission from the Invisible Father. So what she ends up creating is just an awful, terrible, scary-looking lion-headed snake with glowing red eyes named Yaldabaoth, another great Gnostic word. And he is the first Archon. He is the chief Archon. So we talked about aeons just now. Archon is a Greek word meaning ruler or governor or something to that effect. And archons exist in the cosmos. They exist beyond the separation between that which is above and that which is below. And so Yaldabaoth, he is the first one of these. So he's sitting there all by himself, and he's chilling out, and he thinks, gee, wouldn't it be great, right, to have my own kingdom? And he can kind of see a reflection of the perfection, the Pleroma, but he doesn't really know what he's looking at. But he says that's a good enough model, because that's really all he has to look at. So he decides to create on his own a universe that mirrors, although very imperfectly, the perfection of the Pleroma.
And these archons that he creates and gives birth to, they, among other things, there are seven rulers of the planetary spheres. And there's also 12 archons. Now, do they rule the constellations?
Yeah, the 12 authorities. I don't think it actually specifically says that it rules the constellations, although now I'm second-guessing. It might, but it's definitely implied that they do.
So the Sethians had a very different view of, or a very different take on astrology than we might.
Right, right. They had it kind of reversed. We think about astrology as in, you know, let's see what our stars have in store for us so that we can, you know, we can direct our fate. You know, they wanted to get out of it altogether. They weren't happy with fate at all.
And the idea of fate was a common theme in literature of the time, and it was thought of as something that exactly that we that mankind was trapped by. And the revelation of Seth or of Jesus the Soter set us free from fate.
So getting back now to the, we won't necessarily get into all the specific emanations of the archons here, but the authorities are emanated first, followed by the seven kings of the seven heavens, which are the planetary spheres, and the five kings of the depths of the abyss, and then there are powers. And what happens at this point is the demiurge emanates seven powers, but because at this point the Sophia has realized that she's made a mistake, and so she puts secret stuff in with those seven powers. So the seven powers that are emanated are Athoth, Eliu, Astaphio, Yao, Sabaoth, Adonin, and Sebation. And then in with Athoth, Sophia sneaks in goodness. And in with Eliu, Sophia sneaks in pronoia, or forethought. And in with Astaphio, she sneaks in divinity, and so on and so forth. So that within the demiurge now, and the seven powers, there is higher stuff. There's a divine spark in them.
And that's what enables mankind to come to life, right?
Right. And in fact, let's sneak right down there. So the in an interesting bit of math that I have yet to actually figure out, though I heard somebody had a pretty good explanation of it, the seven powers multiply themselves six times each until they get to 365 angels. And in the longer version, we mentioned that there are several versions of the Apocryphon of John. In the longer version, each of these 365 angels kind of create a part of the body of Adam, which we're getting to down here in the creation of Adam. The demiurge says, hey, let's create ourselves a person that can worship us. And he looks up and he can see the Gerademos, the primordial Adam. And so he instructs his archons, to create something just like it. Although obviously, because he's deficient and evil, then what he's going to come out with is not a very good representation at all.
And he wasn't even able to stand up, the original Adam.
Right, right. Because originally, the 365 angels created the body. The seven powers created seven different parts of the soul, but the spirit was missing. So in again steps Sophia, this time in the form of Zoe, life, which is a Greek word for life. And Zoe has fallen. Oh no, she hasn't come in yet. This is still from above. They whisper into the demiurge's ear, hey, guess what? You know, your little dude you made there, he's not standing up yet. But if you breathe your spirit into him, then he'll stand up. And he does, and Adam stands up, and then that's when all the trouble begins, right?
Right, but Adam is made alive, a living being, by the breath of Sophia, via Yaldabaoth,
mm-hmm.
and who is quite shocked along with the other rulers, when they see Adam, because
right.
they realize that he is superior to the Argons.
Right, and that comes about because now this is where Zoe comes in. Zoe is the fallen version of Sophia, the version of Sophia that exists within the cosmos. Zoe hides within Adam, and the Demiurge and the Archons try and remove that power from Adam and place it in another creature, Eve, that they have created out of clay, in order to further control Adam. So this is, they draw that power out of Adam and they put it into Eve. So now this power, or the epinoia of light, as it's called in the text also, or Zoe, now resides in Eve. And so Eve is now the one with the divine spark, and Adam recognizes that. And this is the point in the Genesis story where they realize that they're naked and they're ashamed.
Right, and the rulers saw paradise, or the Garden of Eden, as a place to keep Adam and Eve trapped.
Right,
and they commanded them. They allowed them to eat the tree, the so-called tree of life, which was really the tree of death. And he absolutely forbade them to eat from the tree of knowledge, the tree of gnosis, essentially trying to keep them dumb and trapped in the garden.
Yeah, yeah. And then Sophia, Zoe, appears in the form of an eagle on the tree of life, teaches them all about what's going on, and at this point the Demiurge decides to essentially rape Eve, because he wants to trap her power through the act of sexual intercourse. And this, according to the Gnostics, is the origin of sexual intercourse. But Zoe, Sophia, escapes through the help of intercession from above, and Cain and Abel are born as the children of Eve and the Demiurge. They're also known as... Elohim and Yahweh, I think, are their two other names, although I didn't write that down. And so those are kind of tongue-in-cheek references to other names for God in the Old Testament in the Hebrew Bible. But then Adam and Eve have together Seth, and the rest is history.
And Seth was in the image of the heavenly Seth, the pre-existent Seth, right?
Yes, yeah. He is the actual divine, the actual earthly reflection of the divine Gerademos.
And, prior to the interaction with the Christian community, the Sethian community saw Seth as the Redeemer figure.
Right.
Before adopting Christian language as sort of a Christian gloss. That came a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah, and then even after the Christian gloss, there was a version of Sethianism where Jesus was actually a reincarnation of Seth.
Right. Yeah, they probably originated among, as we said, among apocalyptic Jewish groups, they sort of transitioned into. A Christianity. It ended up with a mashup of Sethianism and nascent Christianity. And then as the sort of homogenized orthodoxy or proto-orthodoxy began to take over in the church, they sort of went their separate ways. And I think John Turner and others have said that they later took on a more Platonic character, Platonic as in Plato. Mm-hmm. But we're rejected by the Neoplatonists because largely on the grounds that to the Neoplatonist the Demiurge was absolutely a wonderful creature, and to the Sethians he was precisely the opposite. So they didn't really find a home among the Neoplatonists, and then later on sort of scattered into several different groups. The Borborites, the Acontics, the Phibianites, the Audians, and some of these groups continued on for some time, even in the early Middle Ages.
Yeah, ideas that stick, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after this this emanations and the creation story, the text goes on to talk about, well, it has a dialogue between Jesus, the ascended Jesus, and John, who answers a lot of questions for him about the different ways that people will be, that the different types of souls, how they'll be treated after they die and all of that. And you can read that for yourself. It's not a very long text, but it's certainly got lots of stuff in there for you to chew over for the rest of your life. Before we go on to our show closing business here, we did have one question from YouTube from our friend John. Was Barbella unique to the Sethians, or was she more widely known? You have an answer for that?
The only place that I've seen her referenced is in Sethian literature.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of identified with her. I don't think she shows up, for instance, in the Valentinian literature, at least not by that name.
Right, and certainly not outside of the Gnostic circles. I mean, Barbella, I don't think, was a Platonic figure.
No, and folks aren't even sure exactly where the name comes from. I've seen several stabs at trying to guess, but they're just guesses.
Barbella refers to the first emanation of God in Gnosticism, often depicted as a supreme female principle, but referred to as Mother Father, so androgynous. She was also a trinity. In the Book of John, also part of the Nag Hammadi library, the Barbella is described as the first power, the glory, Barbella, the perfect glory in the eons, the glory of revelation. The text describes her as, quote, "This is the first thought, his image. She became the womb of everything, for it is she who is prior to them all, the mother father, the first man, Anthropos, the Holy Spirit, the thrice male, the thrice powerful, the thrice named, androgynous one, and the eternal aeon among the invisible ones, and the first to come forth." Epiphanius of Salamis, the oracle of Palestine, was the bishop of Salamis, Cyprus, at the end of the 4th century. He is considered a saint and a church father by both the Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches. His most important work involved documenting a very large compilation of the heresies up to his own time, full of quotations that are often the only surviving fragments of suppressed texts. An example comes from the Book of Noria, Noah's legendary wife. Quote, "For Noah was obedient to the Archon, they say, but Noria revealed the powers on high and Barbella, the scion of the powers, the opposite of the Archon, as the other powers are, and she intimated that what has been taken from the Mother on high by the Archon who made the world, and others with him, gods, demons, and angels, must be gathered from the power in the bodies through the male and female emissions." This is referring to tantric rituals and the goal of attaining primordial spiritual unity through erotic bliss and the consumption of bodily fluids. In esoteric interpretations of the Garden of Eden story, the serpent plays the role of the trickster, a term that in mythology and religion is a character in the story that holds secret knowledge and usually disobeys the rules. Sometimes associated with Lucifer, which in Latin means light bearer, the serpent tries to encourage them to touch the forbidden fruit but not to eat of it. The forbidden fruit represents the orgasm, and this interpretation has not been fully explained in modern Bibles, and is part of the guarded oral knowledge that was historically withheld from the masses, and goes by various names, such as Kabbalah. It is by arousing the carnal energy, but not expelling it, or spilling the cup of Hermes, but by prolonged arousal that the energy can then be harnessed, redirected, and transmuted using various techniques that I discussed earlier and in prior presentations. This is the way that prana, chi, ki, vril, or life force energy is used to activate the pineal gland, which is said to give one access to the subconscious or collective unconscious mind, another way of saying divine gnosis, enlightenment, or in the nomenclature of the mystery schools, light. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those who are interested. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments. So please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.